don't let your mouth make you sin, and don't defend yourself by telling the temple messenger that the promise you made was a mistake. That would make God angry, and he might wipe out everything you have achieved. Talk is cheap, like daydreams and other useless activities. Fear God instead. Now, we're opening this chapter by talking about what it means and what it looks like to take God seriously. Okay, he talks about having some form of reverence when you come to the temple. That was for them, the Jews. That's their main place of worship and sacrifice in the Old Testament. And as he's saying, when you enter and stand before God and worship, that you would have some form of reverence, that you'd honor God, both with your outward attitudes, probably your physical appearance. He says, don't be too casual. Okay, don't talk too much. Don't promise more than you should. When you stand before God, you don't always get that immediate response of what you think God's saying back to you. And so it's easy to go on and on and on. It's easy to think it doesn't matter, the inner attitude I have, but also the outer posture and attitude that I have. I might be looking at my phone and scrolling the whole time during a church service. It's possible to have some form of just a selfish, you're there, but you're not really there for God attitude. And he's saying, don't do that. Don't be too casual. He says, don't make more promises than you're able to keep. Okay, that's something where God is actually going to hold you accountable to the things you promised. Jesus comes along and he starts teaching all these different parables and teachings. And he says simply, let your yes be yes and let your no be no. And don't try and make these elaborate promises like you're going to impress God with some great plan that you came up with. Instead, just be simple in your obedience. Be simple in your approach to God. Okay? Here's the bottom line. There is an accurate way to approach God. There's an accurate way to come before God where you're doing it for him, not for you. You're giving him the honor he deserves, the attention he deserves, the reverence he deserves. And it's not about being pretend and fake holy. It's about a heart attitude toward God that takes him serious, that actually pays attention to who he is and what he asks. Because the Bible tells us all sorts of things about God. It says all sorts of things. He's a father. He's a friend. He's our savior. He saves us from wrath to come. But he's also the judge, the one doing the judging. He's our creator. The Bible tells us all about God. And it's not like it's this complicated relationship where we have to come to some balance of all these things and honor him appropriately in every single way like that. But we have to be aware of these things. And when it says at the very end of our text that we just finished reading, fear God instead, that means to take him seriously for everything he is. Don't pick and choose the things you like about God and leave your worship at that or leave your obedience at that. It's easy to look at God and say, okay, I'm good at obeying him in this way. This comes naturally or easy to me. I prefer this. This is my natural personality preference. I'm going to focus on the friendly, cuddly, sheep-carrying version of God that we know of Jesus. It's easy to say, okay, that's who God is. And it's true. But we can't hold to only that and discard the rest of what the Bible says about him. God is a God of justice. He's a God of wrath. He's a God of truth. He's a God that towers over everything in the universe, so much so that the speck of dust that we're floating on the earth, that is the earth, I should say, the speck of dust, it's God, his feet just stomp all over it and he doesn't even notice. He's so big and he's so great and he's so vast. We can accurately come before God in a way that honors him and observes who he is. And the Bible is what tells us what that is. Okay, we're supposed to respect God. He deserves our respect. We're supposed to give attention to God. The Bible says, give ear to him. That's what that means. Pay attention to him. Give him the attention he deserves. Okay, a lot of us come from different traditions, different Christian church traditions. You know, there's people that are Catholic in the room or grew up Catholic. That's where I came from. Okay, it was a low-lit room with an echoey hall. And kind of a serious or almost reverent and solemn feel and appeal to it. And that's how I learned what it meant to approach God. Okay, some of you grew up Lutheran. Okay, it's like Catholic, except the lights are turned up a little bit higher. And there's more smiles on faces, I guess. That's like the difference. Catholic, and there's a difference in beliefs too, but in terms of, there's still a formal liturgical church service that goes through a pattern and repeats a sort of this worship pattern. Some people grew up Baptist. That can seem more formal, more dressy, maybe even more, I don't know, strict, depending upon what you grew up with. Baptist spans along a lot of ways. There's non-denominational, which just means nightclub church, laser light show. It means casual. It means we don't hold any of the other traditions, and so we create our own new tradition and call it non-denominational. There's people that grew up going to no church, and you don't have any expectation for what you're supposed to be and do. These traditions that we grow up in, they form our approach to God. When we come before Him, and that's what Solomon's talking about, on a weekly basis, on your Sabbath, on your day of worship, when you come before God, what should you act like? He was an Orthodox Jew who grew up in the 1000s BC, basically, and his was a solemn and reverent approach to God. Take him serious. He's powerful. He's mighty. That's the God he was worshiping. What I'd like to say to all of you is, whatever your tradition was, whatever you grew up with, don't let that formulate how you have to worship God. Okay? Because a lot of times these traditions, they capture part of it, but not all of it. They would lead you to believe that this is the most important aspect of God, and they kind of box you into one. And I'm not saying compare all of them and find what's best and pick the best parts of each one. I'm saying if you're going to have something form how you worship God, the way you take Him serious, the things you take serious of Him, let it be the Bible. Let it be His word. Let it be His revelation of who He is and what He wants. This is where Solomon's people got it wrong in the Old Testament. And again, Jesus comes along and He teaches the Jewish people. He says, you need to go and figure out what this means. Okay, go and learn what this Old Testament scripture is from Hosea chapter 6. I think it's verse 6. It says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. I desire knowledge of God, not burnt offerings. The people were there to sacrifice animals, to basically make God happy through their sacrifice. But God wanted them to pay attention to Him, not the animals that were being sacrificed, and not to themselves and what they were offering. He wanted them to give Him their worship. I desire mercy and not sacrifice, knowledge of God, not burnt offerings. Let God define how you worship Him. That's what I'm saying. Solomon puts us in a good place here. Ecclesiastes, be cautious, be careful. God is our Father, so you can come and tell Him anything you want. You can say everything you need to. He already knows what you're thinking. And yet, there's some ways in which, if you're giving respect and honor to a person, you're not going to say everything you're thinking, because some of the things you're thinking are not respectful. They're not honorable. And He may already know those things, but have some form of self-control to give God your best and not your worst. It's okay to give God your worst again, but should that be every time? Should that be your only worship? He already knows what's there. And when it comes to worshiping and honoring Him, it's important that we take Him serious as to what He's asking of us. The punchline of this section was, fear God instead. Let's keep going. Don't be surprised if you see a poor person being oppressed by a powerful, and if justice is being miscarried throughout the land. For every official is under orders from higher up, and matters of justice get lost in red tape and bureaucracy. Even the king milks the land for his own profit. Those who love money will never have enough. How meaningless to think that wealth brings true happiness. The more you have, the more people come to help you spend it. So what good is wealth, except perhaps to watch it slip through your fingers? People who work hard sleep well, whether they eat little or much. But the rich seldom get a good night's sleep. There is another problem I've seen under the sun. Hoarding riches harms the saver. Money is put into risky investments that turn sour, and everything is lost. In the end, there's nothing left to pass on to one's children. We all come to the end of our lives as naked and empty-handed as on the day we are born. We can't take our riches with us. And this too is a very serious problem. People leave this world no better off than when they came. All their hard work is for nothing, like working for the wind. Throughout their lives, they live under a cloud, frustrated, discouraged, and angry. Even so, I've noticed one thing, at least that is good. It is good for people to eat, drink, and enjoy their work under the sun during the short life God has given them, and to accept their lot in life. And it is a good thing to receive wealth from God and the good health to enjoy it. To enjoy your work and to accept your lot in life, this is indeed a gift from God. God keeps such people so busy enjoying life that they take no time to brood over the past. So the first paragraph there in verse 8, he's commenting on some of the factors that lead to injustice in this world. Okay, injustice doesn't always come with the strong eating the weak, like a survival of the fittest in the jungle mentality, or a wild, wild west, whoever can draw their gun the fastest wins. Sometimes injustice comes through the governments that form in civilization because the people that work in those governments are greedy and corrupt and are going to pervert justice. So just because there's a form of law and rule and stability in the place that you live, that doesn't mean justice is going to be served. Not automatically. People are greedy, I guess. People are corrupt. He mentions bureaucracy here. Bureaucracy is just layers of authority. We go to the Philippines sometimes. I'm planning to go back in November. It's the most hilarious thing you've ever seen. Okay, the Philippines, it's an island nation. Okay, of many islands. It's a nation of many islands. That works. Okay, is it almost impossible to travel about without at some point needing to get on a boat to travel to another island, okay? Because there's like 7,000 islands and they're not that big. You go to the ferry station and the layers of bureaucracy for you to arrive at the dock to getting on the boat are extreme, okay? You buy your ticket, but before you can buy your ticket, you have to go through the security check. Before you can go through the security check, you have to go through the passport check. Okay, so you go into the ferry terminal and you go through these different steps, and it's always a different line, and you're checking out with a different person. They make a little mark on your ticket every step of the way. Then you get through the building and you go out, and between the ferry terminal and getting to your seat on the boat, there's like seven or eight people are going to say, "Excuse me, sir," and they're going to check your ticket and mark it off. This is a poor example of bureaucracy, but yet that's the idea. Bureaucracy slows things down. It keeps things from moving freely. It kind of guarantees some level of control by, you know, herding people through lines, by making you wait, by making everybody go through these hoops to jump through. That's bureaucracy. And he says a lot of times that place, that sort of thing, is ripe for corruption. There's opportunities for people to take bribes, to cheat the system. You can bet that it's not the system that's bad, although it is terrible, by the way. It's the people working it. That's the problem. Okay, government is supposed to bring civilization, but often it exposes sin instead because there's people working in government. And so he says that's one source of injustice. He said part of the big motivator behind that, that's the rest of the paragraph we read, is that people are greedy. They want money. And they want to get it any way they can. So they look for opportunities. Okay, some people are entrepreneurial in these efforts. Some people are opportunists. That's what we're talking about here. You see an opportunity to make some money. Okay, so my neighbors have a little lemonade stand out there. It's drawn in all the customers. They've got good advertising all over the city. 25 cents a cup. If you're an opportunist and you're a 40-year-old man and a little bit pathetic, you set up a table right next to them and charge 20 cents. I'd have to pay for the advertising, so I'm probably doing pretty good taking advantage of the situation. People are greedy. People will look for all sorts of ways to collect and make money, to gain control over other people. The primary thing that's being talked about here is wealth. saying people that have a lot of money actually have a lot more problems in life than those who don't. You may or may not believe that. He says to have more money will lead to more anxiety. You have to worry about what to do with it. Is it going to sit in, you know, in a bank account? And is it going to keep up with the level of inflation that's currently going on? By the way, if you had $1,000 in a bank account in the year, we'll say 2020, okay, how much spending power is that $1,000 now in the year 2024? Inflation was, you know, 3 to 4% most of the time, but it got up to 9% one year. So since then, it's been about 20% inflation here in the U.S. So the $1,000 that you worked hard to save, you can now buy the equivalent of, at that time, $800 worth of goods. Okay, so if you have $1,000 and if that's a lot of money to you, then you're like, oh, dang, I need to find a new bank that pays better interest. I need to get involved in some investments, make sure my money is making money. Imagine you're a millionaire. Imagine you got, instead of the $1 million, instead of $1,000, you have $1 million. Well, now that's only worth spending, purchasing power-wise, about $800,000. So you lost $200,000. This is the type of anxiety people have when they have wealth and money. You buy a house, you got to take care of it. You know, you form a good retirement plan. We got to pay some guy to take care of it. America is weird, one of the weirdest countries in the world. We pay people to take care of our money for us. Okay? Because, I don't know, it seems inconvenient to do it ourselves. I don't know. But people that have money have that as something extra to think about, something extra to worry about. Okay, last week we were talking about the Christmas Carol. Christmas Story would be a totally different application. Christmas Carol, remember Ebenezer Scrooge? We're talking about him. Being wealthy and cold-hearted, I'd like to bring your attention to a different Scrooge this week. Okay, this is Uncle Scrooge from DuckTales. Anybody know this one? Scrooge McDuck, he built a tower to put his gold coins in, but then he built a diving board at the top so he could jump off it and swim in his gold coins. It's pretty cool. Okay. He had so much money that he had to build a building to house his money. And then he had to basically watch over it. And he was paranoid, if anybody remembers the show. I was a kid when I watched it. I still remember thinking, that's the coolest thing ever, but how stupid. He's afraid to spend it on his three cool little nephews. People that have money have extra worries. They have to take care of it. They have something to do with it. It does many things to us. Causes anxiety. It also causes greed. Greed begets greed. Money begets greed. You have to be very careful on this one. Jesus taught to the crowds. He said, he said the sin of greed will affect and distort the way you look at the world around you. He says, he's talking about greed. He's talking about money. And he says, your eye is your lamp to your soul. Okay, it lets the light in so you can see the world around. He's talking about greed. He's saying in that scenario, you're going to want more. You're going to skew the world around you to see where you can get and how you can get more. Having money causes greed. It's about the most natural thing to the human, you know, the human condition. We're all sinners. And you're going to want to collect and you're going to want to keep for yourself. It'll cause you distraction from God. And he mentions in this section here that the answer is really contentment. Look at verse 18. Okay, even so, I've noticed this one thing that is good. Okay, and it goes on. At the end of that verse says, for people to accept their lot in life. Okay, and then skip halfway through verse 19. To enjoy your work and accept your lot in life, this indeed is a gift from God. Okay, contentment is the answer to this problem. You can't always control, this is going to sound weird, you can't always control whether you're wealthy or not. Most people would say on the side of not being wealthy, yeah, I understand that. I can't control that I'm not wealthy. Some people are wealthy and they can't control that. Some people are wealthy and they don't want to be because of the problems and the greed and all the rest it creates. But they don't have a choice. Do they intentionally be poor? Is that what they should do? Give away all their money so that they don't have these problems? You know, these more money, more problems, problems? The answer is no. Don't seek to be poor. That's what Paul tells us in the New Testament. Don't seek to be in a different position than you were in when you came to the Lord. The answer is learn how to be content. And that's what the New Testament teaches us. Philippians chapter 4, Paul's describing how he had to learn how to be content when he had a lot and when he had very little. Okay, the answer to greed is contentment. Okay, that's being thankful for what you do have, not being worried about what you don't have. Being okay with where God's placed you in life, what he's given you, and what he hasn't. Being content. Okay, the answer of, okay, how do I fix my heart from becoming greedy? How do I prevent myself from becoming greedy after money? It's not, okay, learn to hate money. It's learn to be content with where God has you in life. If you guys have a New Testament Bible in front of you, flip to 1 Timothy chapter 6. This is a passage that's walking down just about the exact same parallel. It's on page 180. Yeah, 180 if you've got the Street Level Bible. He's walking down the exact same parallel. There are pitfalls if you're not going to be content. If you're going to ignore this and go after money, there's going to be major pitfalls to your spiritual life. I'm going to start halfway through verse 2. It's 1 Timothy chapter 6. It says, "Teach these things, Timothy, and encourage everyone to obey them. Some people may contradict our teaching, but these are the wholesome teachings of our Lord Jesus Christ. These teachings promote a godly life. Anyone who teaches something different is arrogant and lacks understanding. Such a person has an unhealthy desire to quibble over the meaning of words. This stirs up arguments, ending in jealousy, division, slander, and evil suspicions. These people always cause trouble. Their minds are corrupt. They have turned their backs on the truth. To them, a show of godliness is just a way to become wealthy." Okay, now verse 6 on, this is the point. "Yet true godliness with contentment is itself great wealth. After all, we brought nothing with us when we came into the world, and we can't take anything with us when we leave it. So if we have enough food and clothing, let us be content. But people who long to be rich fall into temptation and are trapped by many foolish and harmful desires that plunge them into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. And some people, craving money, have wandered away from the truth, away from the true faith, and pierced themselves with many sorrows." Jesus said it's impossible to love both God and money. You'll end up loving one and hating the other. You end up serving one and despising the other. It's impossible to do both. Money has its place. In our world, you need money to live. It's how we pay for stuff. It's how we buy Beanie Babies. It's how we get ourselves into position to pay our rents, to have a car, pay for gas, to drive to work. Money has its place, but we can't love money. Not if we want to love Jesus. And these two things are mutually exclusive. Okay? If anybody knows Venn diagrams, you got one circle and you got another circle. If those two circles are completely separate, no overlap in the middle, that's what we call mutually exclusive. And that's the way it needs to be. I think oftentimes we let those two circles blur together in the middle to where there's a little bit of overlap or a lot of overlap. You can't love money. You can't serve money. We need to be content with what God has given you, not wish you had more. Okay, and as we get into chapter 6, we'll go on with, we'll come back to this idea of contentment a little bit more. So let's jump in. There's another serious tragedy I've seen under the sun, and it weighs heavily on humanity. God gives some people great wealth and honor and everything they could ever want, but then he doesn't give them the chance to enjoy these things. They die, and someone else, even a stranger, ends up enjoying their wealth. This is meaningless, a sickening tragedy. A man might have 100 children and live to be very old, but if he finds no satisfaction in life and doesn't even get a decent burial, it would have been better for him to be born dead. His birth would have been meaningless, and he would have ended in darkness. He wouldn't even have had a name, and he would never have seen the sun or known of its existence. Yet he would have had more peace than growing up to be an unhappy man. He might live 1,000 years twice over, but still find no contentment. And since he must die like everyone else, well, what's the use? All people spend their lives scratching for food, but they never seem to have enough. So are wise people really better off than fools? Do poor people gain anything for being wise and knowing how to act in front of others? Enjoy what you have rather than desiring what you don't have. Just dreaming about nice things is meaningless, like chasing the wind. Everything has already been decided. It was known long ago what each person would be, so there's no use arguing with God about your destiny. The more words you speak, the less they mean, so what good are they? In the few days of our meaningless lives, who knows how our days can best be spent? Our lives are like a shadow. Who can tell what will happen on this earth after we are gone? Okay, now he's just starting to meander in all these thoughts at the end. Here's what he's saying. Three things I'm picking out of there. Okay, life doesn't always turn out the way we hope it will. Okay, some people, their lives are shorter than what they would have hoped. They're shorter than what their loved ones would have hoped. There are people that die younger than others. There are people that die tragically young. Nobody's guaranteed a long life. Nobody's guaranteed old age. God determines when it's our time. Now, the choices we make influence that. We won't die ahead of our time. God, we won't die without God's allowing it, if that's what's going to happen. We can make foolish choices that put us on the verge of that, but nobody's guaranteed a long life. Okay, and I think when we're young, I think we automatically envision the stages of life into the future. Okay, I'll go to college, I'll meet somebody, we'll get married, we'll buy a house, we'll have kids, we'll have careers. Later on, we'll retire, our kids will have kids, we'll have grandchildren. I think we envision this long life when we're young. But there's no guarantee of that. And the Bible is brutally honest about this, by the way. And it's not pleasant. I mean, it's not like this is a fun thought. But this is real. This is reality. Okay, and we'll come back to this thought about always remembering that you are going to die one day as we get into chapter 7 in a minute. Second thing, so dying young, there's no guarantee of long life. That's the first one. The second one, there's no guarantee that getting old is going to mean you're going to have a good life. There's no guarantee that just because you live into your 70s or 80s, that you get the job that you want or have kids. He said a man could have 1,000 kids and still feel regret about his life. There's no guarantee that a good long life by numbers, that that'll amount to anything. That you won't just sit on your deathbed and regret the choices you made or didn't make. Okay, so there's no guarantees in life. There's no guarantees that you live long. There's no guarantees that your long life will be fulfilling. And the third thing he says, there's no guarantee that living responsibly is actually any better than living foolishly. Okay. Now he's getting on the verge of madness. Because I read that and I think that's wrong. I think what he's saying is wrong. I think there are moments in this book where he's saying things to us that he intends for us to react to as, wait a minute. hold on, that does not seem right. I think he's challenging our thinking. I think he's making sure we're paying attention, that we're awake, that we're actually listening to what he's saying. He says, knowing that the right way to live doesn't guarantee an easy life. Just because you do things in a respectable, responsible way, that doesn't necessarily mean that things will go easy for you. There are still bumps along the way. There's still surprises in life. So there's no guarantees in any of this. And I think a lot of us live as if there are guarantees, don't we? We got life figured out, at least to the way where we can do this. I don't know, I just shoved somebody in my head and expect the exact perfect response to that, or, you know, reciprocal. If you shove somebody, you're going to get shoved back. You can expect that. But there's no guarantee that if you make wise choices, there's no guarantee that if you eat the right foods, have a healthy diet, exercise, there's no guarantee that you're going to live a good, long life. And there's no guarantees that that long life that you do live, that you're going to be satisfied with it just because you go through the stages that you were hoping would happen. Okay, here's where he comes back to contentment. Okay, and I'm looking at verse 9. Enjoy what you have rather than desiring what you don't have. So enjoy what you have. Okay, he says, dreaming about nice things is meaningless. I think of all the time I waste dreaming about nice things, and he tells me it's meaningless. And I'm like, really? I guess it doesn't accomplish anything, not technically. Enjoy what you have. Enjoy the time that you do have. Don't wish you were somewhere else. Don't wish you had more time to do a certain thing. How about you just appreciate the time that you do have and that you do get to have the thing? Okay, there's no guarantees in life. And if you'll be content, if you'll enjoy who God is, what he's given, and what he hasn't, that's where there's a semi-guarantee that you will be fulfilled with your life. Because you'll be fulfilled with God. That's what he's driving at. Let's jump into chapter 7. He's getting a little random here. He's going Proverbs on us, okay? And Solomon wrote a lot of Proverbs. And apparently the book of Proverbs wasn't enough for him, so he had to sandwich some into Ecclesiastes here for us. So chapter 7, a good reputation is more valuable than costly perfume, and the day you die is better than the day you're born. Real quick, this idea of Proverbs in the Bible, sometimes there's like this pairing of two things. It'll say one thing and say another, and it's drawing a parallel. So sometimes it'll say one thing, and then the second line will be a conclusion on the matter, a definitive statement. Sometimes it's meant to make you think, to tease your imagination. And so as we read through these, it's not like they're a poem. It's not like they're like these rhyming, riddles. It's not like there's these wise statements that are supposed to follow some pattern. You'll see it as we go here. Okay, good reputation is more valuable than costly perfume. And the day you die is better than the day you were born. Better to spend time at funerals than at parties. After all, everyone dies, so the living should take this to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for sadness has a refining influence on us. A wise person thinks about death a lot, while a fool only thinks about having a good time. Better to be criticized by a wise person than to be praised by a fool. A fool's laughter is quickly gone, like thorns crackling in a fire. This is also meaningless. Extortion turns wise people into fools, and bribes corrupt the heart. Finishing is better than starting. Patience is better than pride. Control your temper, for anger labels you a fool. Don't long for the good old days. This is not wise. Wisdom is even better when you have money. Both are a benefit as you go through life. Wisdom and money can get you almost anything, but only wisdom can save your life. Accept the way God does things, for who can straighten what he has made crooked? Enjoy prosperity while you can, but when hard times strike, realize that both come from God. Remember that nothing is certain in this life. This idea of Proverbs that help us have some understanding of what wisdom applied to life looks like, there's kind of three categories when it comes to Proverbs. There's wise, there's foolish, and then there's outright evil. Okay, wisdom is always godly, it's always holiness, it's always honoring and fearing God in the appropriate ways, giving the attention to God. That's always wisdom in the Bible. It's not smarts, it's not like street smarts. That's not what wisdom is in the Bible. It's being godly. There is foolish, and that would be somebody who lives life recklessly, ignores God, ignores the consequences, tries to just have a good time all the time. That's the category of foolish in the Proverbs. And there's evil. That's people that try and hurt and harm other people through their actions. Okay, and Proverbs kind of sorts these out. If you read the book of Proverbs, going through the Old Testament, it's a lot of the same stuff that we just read through here. I'm going to pull out three things real quick, and then we'll finish up the chapter and call it a night. He mentioned in verse 1, a good reputation is more valuable than costly perfume. The bottom line is character is better than stuff. Your own personal character, who you are, having a solid morality about you that matches to God, having a strength of character that does the right thing at the right time, in the right place, with the right people, that's better than whatever stuff you can accumulate for yourself. And you can accumulate a good character. through God's presence in your life, through reading his word and understanding who he is and what he wants, through doing things his way. That's how you build your character to be strong and reliable. And it's more reliable than whatever stuff you accumulate. Okay, I'm not saying you don't need stuff to some extent. I'm saying it's easy to focus on stuff and always ignore the character. That's unwise. If you want to be wise, put yourself in a good position to follow God and live a good life for him. Your character is what matters. And he calls it reputation here, but it's the same. The second one, never forget that you will die. Okay, that's verse 4 of chapter 7. A wise person thinks a lot about death. It sounds kind of morbid, doesn't it? A wise person thinks a lot about death. I think this is putting into context that your life has a beginning and it has an end. I don't think this is daydreaming about your own death, wondering how it's going to happen and when it's going to happen, like shark attack. Like, that'd be the way to do it. Or having some plan for it. This is measuring your life to say, it started here, one day it will end. I better have a plan for where I'm at now in my life. I don't know when the end's coming, but I know it is. And so if I'm going to do stuff, if I'm going to live the way I think God wants me to live, I better get started now. I better not wait for a future time, because I don't know when that future time is going to be. Thinking about death helps put life into context. Last one we'll look at here is verse 13. Accept the way God does things. Who can straighten out what he has made crooked? Okay, so if God has made things a certain way and we spend all of our time trying to correct what God has done, we'll be fighting against God. We will find that we're fighting against what he has already laid out for us. And it'll be a big waste of time. Okay, you ever seen somebody try and bend a metal bar, like a thick, you know, concrete rebar? Where's John? Okay. I've seen John try and do it before. I think he was about, I don't know. Hold on, I'm mixing up my stories. We'll talk later. If you see somebody trying to do it, it's kind of a fool's errand. It's pretty hard to do. Okay. If you try and walk through a path in life, and God has said, here's the path, and it's fairly evident to you, you know where it is, you know where it turns, and you have some sense of where it's traveling, to go off-road on the path, to try and take a shortcut to get something, or maybe you see something off that path that you would prefer was the destination. You see where the path is going, and that's not really what you want. You want something that's out there. That's the same idea. Okay, so accept God's way, accept what he wants, acknowledge his way, and follow it. This unlocks in your life the true meaning. This unlocks a peace within you to stop fighting against God and to actually live for him, to acknowledge his path. This will actually relieve a lot of the stress, the anxiety, the hopelessness that we can have in life. Because a lot of the times when we're fighting against God, we don't realize it until it's too late. You can spend a lot of time fighting against God, trying to fix, in air quotes, something that you see is wrong, when really that's God's ordained way. And if you'd only embrace what he's doing in your life, you might find that he's got a purpose for it, a meaning in it. Let's finish up chapter 7. Verse 15, I've seen everything in this meaningless life, including death of good young people and long life of wicked people. So don't be too good or too wise. Why destroy yourself? On the other hand, don't be too wicked either. Don't be a fool. Why die before your time? Pay attention to these instructions, or anyone who fears God will avoid both extremes. And again, it's just telling us, you do have, the way you live does have an effect on the outcome of your life. Verse 19, one wise person is stronger than 10 leading citizens of a town. Verse 20, not a single person on this earth is always good and never sins. Don't eavesdrop on others. You may hear your servant curse you, for you know how often you yourself have cursed others. I have always tried my best to let wisdom guide my thoughts and actions. I said to myself, I am determined to be wise, but it didn't work. Wisdom is always distant and difficult to find. I searched everywhere, determined to find wisdom and to understand the reason for things. I was determined to prove to myself that wickedness is stupid and foolishness is madness. I discovered that a seductive woman is a trap more bitter than death. Her passion is a snare and her soft hands are chains. Those who are pleasing to God will escape her, but sinners will be caught in her snare. This is my conclusion, says the teacher. I discovered this after looking at the matter from every possible angle. Though I have searched repeatedly, I have not found what I was looking for. Only one out of 1,000 men is virtuous, but not one woman. But I did find this. God created people to be virtuous, but they have each turned to follow their own downward path. Okay, let me untangle this a minute, real quick. This translation does not do a good job of capturing those last two lines and what it means. Solomon is searching for what makes people tick. He's searching for how to live a wise life, for what motivates people, and for how they'd actually execute on this. And depending upon, does anybody have different than the street level translation in front of you? Other translations aren't going to mention that a woman is not virtuous, not one woman is virtuous. Here's what he's saying. I'll paraphrase, and you can look at your version, and maybe you'll get this. He's tried to figure people out, and 1,000 men, and he might have figured out one. He can't seem to make sense of what people are, what they do, why they do it. And 1,000 other people, women, none. He could make sense of 1 out of 1,000 guys and 0 out of 1,000 women. He's not saying men are virtuous sometimes and women are not virtuous. He's saying, I can't hardly figure anybody out. I searched. I tried to find what I was looking for. I didn't find it. All I can tell you is that I suck. I barely saw something. That 1 in 1,000 guys is probably himself. That's my guess. And he looks at women and says, I just don't understand them. That's what he's saying. Here's what the main point. It's the last line of what he says there. God created people to be virtuous, but they have each turned to follow their own downward path. People are unpredictable. Everybody sins in their own way. You can look at people and guess what their desires are and guess what their pet sins are and see what's taking them away from God. That's not our job, by the way, but you can observe this and see it. He's saying that everybody has turned away from God, and when he investigated as to why everybody turned away from God, he couldn't figure out everything. So he's making these generalities. That's the point of what he's trying to say. God created people to be virtuous, and they have each turned to follow their own downward path. Look back at verse 20. Not a single person on earth is always good and never sins. Okay. We need God. This isn't a matter of some people are good and some people are bad. That's not Christianity. We need God because everybody has turned to their own way. Everybody has fallen short of God. Everybody has rebelled against him, whether it's in their heart, in their mind, or with their actions. Everybody has rejected God's way. Okay, God created us to know him, to be like him, and yet everybody has rejected that idea. They've done selfishly, sinfully, wrongly. Okay, and that's what he's boiling this down to. I searched and I searched. This is who we are. We're sinners. We need help. Okay? Solomon was looking ahead to a time where Jesus Christ would come to the earth, the Messiah, the king that would reign forever. By the way, that was on Solomon's throne. He was looking ahead to a time where God would save us all. The new heaven would arrive. Okay, God would redeem all things. God would forgive all sin. He would fix the broken world. And Solomon was only looking ahead. Okay, and so you get a glimpse of despair here from him. I guess maybe you can understand that, right? We know Jesus came. He died for our sins. He resurrected from the dead. It proved that he is God. And we don't have to be stuck in this moment that he's describing here. We can have a new life with Jesus. That's what it means to become a Christian, to admit that you're a sinner, to admit that not a single person on earth is always good and never sins, to realize that I've turned to follow my own path, but yet to turn back. That's what becoming a Christian means. You turn back to God. And everybody has that opportunity. I think Solomon gets the diagnosis right here. I don't know that he had the fullest picture of the answer, but we do. We'll stop there for tonight. Let's pray.